You're listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Brody Wilson. This week, we have a special Local Motion for you. We're bringing you a regional roundup from Rocky Mountain Community Radio's Maeve Conran. KVNF is a member of Rocky Mountain Community Radio. It's a fantastic network of community radio stations like KVNF all over the Mountain West that come together to share stories and resources. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome to The Regional Roundup, a production of Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a coalition of public and community radio stations in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, including this one. I'm Caroline Yanez, the coalition's rural climate reporter, in for regular host Maeve Conran. Coming up on today's show, efforts to reintroduce the wolverine to Colorado are underway.
And it's a big weasel that is very much endangered by climate change and by habitat loss and fragmentation.
A beloved gathering place for a small community of Moab locals has been dismantled by the Bureau of Land Management.
I had no desire to put it back together or anything. It's still a beautiful place to go visit and a beautiful place to hang out, but it's definitely different feel.
And the Sundance Film Festival is underway in Park City, the last one in Utah, before it moves to its new home of Boulder, Colorado, next year.
This festival has found a new iteration, and it might just feel like our beginnings over 40 years ago.
From Rocky Mountain Community Radio, it's the Regional Roundup. But first, some regional news. The Federal Department of the Interior has announced the formation of a new agency, the U.S. Wildland Fire Service. Right now, several agencies have firefighting services, including the U.S. Forest Service, which has the largest firefighting workforce and the most aerial resources. Officials say they want to streamline federal responses to fire. But advocates worry the new agency will focus exclusively on fire suppression. Josh Hicks, the Wilderness Society's conservation campaign director, says these federal agencies don't just fight fires. They incorporate fire into their management strategies.
You can't really take fire out of natural resource management in the West. The two are married together. And when you take them out and say, we are now focused on suppressing fire, you've divorced fire from natural resource management within our forest. And it's going to cause more problems than it'll ultimately fix.
He says there's also a lot of uncertainty about the future of this new agency because Congress declined to fund it in its recently passed appropriations package. And with the dry winter we're having in our region, fire season could start at any time. ICE and local law enforcement are investigating an incident near Vail, Colorado. That's where a Latino advocacy nonprofit reported that racist playing cards were left in abandoned cars after the drivers had been detained. Aspen Public Radio's Hallie Zander reports.
The Ace of Spades is sometimes called the death card. Some U.S. soldiers used these cards during the Vietnam War, attaching them to the bodies of dead enemy soldiers. The CIA said it was effective psychological warfare at the time. Printed on the cards were the phone number and physical address of an ICE processing center in Aurora. It's unclear if ICE officials left the cards. An ICE spokesperson condemned the behavior in an email and said the agency is investigating. The Eagle County Sheriff's Office is also looking into the incident and called it disturbing.
Wyoming records an average of 2 avalanche-related deaths each year. The Bridger-Teton forecast region already has hit that number less than halfway through the winter season. KHOL's Jenna McMurtry dropped by a backcountry clinic on Teton Pass to learn how local organizations are helping recreators keep rescue skills fresh.
Nice. Backcountry enthusiasts gathered on skis and splitboards last week to simulate various avalanche rescue scenarios at a beacon park on the west side of Teton Pass. It's the first of 3 free clinics hosted by the Teton Backcountry Alliance and Yostmark this winter. Tate Bjornson is the Alliance's program director. She hopes both the clinics and the parks raise awareness on free places to continue avalanche education.
And the Beacon Park here at Coal Creek is really great for that. As I showed you, you can have up to 8 burials, which hopefully in real life would never happen, but you can practice that way.
There's an orange box fixed to an aspen tree within view of the trailhead. Inside it, backcountry users can flip a switchboard to practice finding one or several of 8 buried signals. I'm Jenna McMurtry, KHOL News.
Preparations are beginning in Colorado to reintroduce another predator to the wild. Wolverines were once native to the state, but their population was wiped out here more than a century ago due to heavy trapping. As KDNK's Lily Jones reports, this effort to bring back the wolverine has the support of some prominent critics of the reintroduction of wolves.
A 2024 bipartisan bill introduced by then-Senator, current Garfield County Commissioner Perry Will, called for Colorado Parks and Wildlife to restore the large weasel to the state starting next year. On January 15th, CPW revealed the Colorado Wolverine Restoration Plan, the first step in a 4-part process to bring Gulogulolouscus back to remote subalpine habitats across the Rockies. Here's Delia Malone, an ecologist with the Roaring Fork Audubon.
They're a big weasel that has been restricted because of us to high elevation habitats. And it's a big weasel that is very much endangered by climate change and by habitat loss and fragmentation. They're kind of scary looking because they are big. They're like a big pine marten. But pine martens are the cutest on the planet. These guys are just big. They're actually beautiful. Their fur, it's probably one of the things that got them into trouble.
Colorado Parks and Wildlife has a somewhat mixed record when it comes to reintroducing predators. Perhaps the agency's most famous success began in 1999 when the lynx returned to our boreal forests. Lynx were nearly non-existent here in the 70s due to trapping, predator poisoning, and massive habitat loss. Today, it's estimated that there are 200 lynx living in the San Juan Mountains. More recently, the gray wolf reintroduction project has attracted criticism from conservationists and ranchers alike. The first wolves were brought here in 2023, and while the project is ongoing, it's hit several bumps, including livestock depredation and one wolf being killed by a car. Currently, CPW has no plans for translocating additional wolves this release season, but is exploring options for the winter of 2026/27. Commissioner Perry Will is not a fan of the gray wolf reintroduction, calling it a failed program at a CPW meeting last June. However, Will was a primary sponsor of the wolverine reintroduction bill during his time in the Senate.
Part of my incentive for running that bill was to really show the governor and really the people of the state how to reintroduce a species the right way, not by ballot box biology.
We got Prop 114 in the wolves by ballot box, you know, and ballot box biology is the absolute worst way in the world to manage our wildlife resource in this state.
Will says his opposition to bringing back the wolves is largely due to their conflict potential with people and livestock.
I don't dislike wolves. I just don't think it's fair to the species because they will be in constant conflict. And, you know, we're such a populated state.
Wolverines are or were native to Colorado until they were wiped out in much the same way as the lynx through unregulated trapping and poisoning.
Back in, you know, the 1860s and so on, when we were moving west, they have this amazingly beautiful dark brown fur with this blonde lateral stripe. And so I'm guessing they ended up as a lot of women's coats.
The reintroduction plan addresses many of the same concerns that Coloradans had with gray wolves, such as livestock depredation and human infrastructure. Commissioner Will says that he expects very little in the way of conflict.
Oh, there'll be a lot less expensive. And wolverines, I just don't think there'll be any compensation. They depredate on livestock so rarely.
Wolverine releases will begin next year, primarily on the western slope in the Sasquatch Range, Elk Mountains, and West Elk Mountains. It is still unclear where CPW is planning to source the animals, but they will spend time recuperating after capture at a facility in Frisco.
Wolverine, just up here on McClure Pass, just up the Crystal River, historically were trapped up there. They will be coming home.
For KDNK News, I'm Lily Jones.
You're listening to the Regional Roundup from Rocky Mountain Community Radio. For decades, Otho Bridge near Moab was a beloved gathering place for a small community of Moab locals. But that era has come to an end. The last person left the canyon a few years ago. And then, last spring, the Bureau of Land Management dismantled the site at Otho Bridge, including the famous sandstone chessboard. KZMU's Emily Arnson has more.
On a winter day about 30 years ago, Drake Harmon went for a hike in Mill Creek Canyon. He'd just moved to Moab, and he had recently become friends with a group of people who were living on public land in that area. On this particular day, he was by himself, exploring some of the side canyons, when he came across something special.
When I first found it, there was only deer trails. It's really overgrown, some springs along the way. And then you enter into the end of the canyon, the Box Canyon, and there's the bridge. The bridge pops out at you.
The bridge he's talking about is actually a sandstone arch that connects two sides of the canyon. Underneath, there's an alcove with one side covered by the arch and the other side open to the sky with this big hole at the top. It's called Otho Bridge.
There are several people living at Mill Creek, mostly in the caves, that I had friended. And I'd found this place on my own in the middle of the winter and shared it with these people. And we went up and everyone took their own little part in making it into a cool little place to lounge out. There was a chessboard and some journals and some chairs and couches that we'd made out of stone.
There's a big flat ledge in the alcove where people had made a little sitting area out of rocks. In the middle, there was a huge chessboard carved into a piece of sandstone. And there were a few notebooks up there, too. Some of them had entries from over 20 years ago. Can you explain what people leave in the notebooks or any memorable entries you've read?
They were all memorable. It was really neat to see people from all over the world that were finding these things and writing stuff in their own language and tons of artwork, just some beautiful poetry. And it was amazing.
Did you ever live up there?
I could say I stayed up there quite a bit.
And what was that period of your life like?
The most relaxing period of my life that I've ever had. Yeah, I was working at the Moab Brewery and I'd wake up without an alarm and jog into work and make it there by 9 o'clock every morning. It was just a very peaceful time in my life. Otho Bridge was saved my life, and it helped a lot of other people through a lot of different things, mental issues. I was taking different individuals up there. Some of them I would stay with them and walk them through whatever they need to go through, and some people I would leave up there for a few days and then come back and check on them. It was a church for us. It was a sanctuary, and we respected it very much.
A lot of Mill Creek Canyon is a wilderness study area, so even though it's public land, there's no camping allowed. And that includes Otho Bridge. Things are pretty different now. The Bureau of Land Management is a lot more strict about enforcing the rules in Mill Creek. That era pretty much ended in the early 2000s. These days, Carmen just takes day trips up to Otho Bridge. When we spoke in the fall, he'd been there recently, and he was surprised by what he found.
It looked like someone had tried to take apart and break the couch, thrown it off the side and broke it in half. And the table with the chessboard on top was dismantled, and it looked like someone tried to put it back together. And there used to be a lot more things up there that got destroyed over time.
Last spring, a group of Bureau of Land Management employees made an unplanned stop at Otho Bridge.
So our park ranger, outdoor recreation specialist, and archaeologist were out on another trip, and two of them had actually never been to that site before, and so took a side trip to go see it.
This is Anna Rakoff. She's a public affairs specialist for the BLM.
And they came across the site at Otho Bridge and recognized that that site was not historic and not an archaeological site and was actually modern-day vandalism. They made the decision on the spot to disassemble that site.
And did the archaeologist or the rec specialist say what deemed this vandalism versus something else?
I'm going to read something just because this is like the clearest kind of letter of the law. Our Archaeological Resources Protection Act and National Historic Preservation Act define vandalism as willfully defacing, disturbing, or removing scientific, cultural, archaeological, or natural objects. And this site specifically was a place where natural resources had been displaced and defaced. So we had rocks that had very clearly been moved and structured as, you know, a table and chairs. You know, the boulder in the center, there was actually carving on that rock. And even as intricate and beautiful as it may be, that was still vandalism. And this is a wilderness study area, so we really want to preserve that natural character of that space. And having anything man-made like this is just not in character with that.
I just wanted to ask about the National Historic Preservation Act. And I know that that typically means if something is older than 50 years old, you have to at least assess whether or not it is culturally or archaeologically significant. And so I'm curious how that assessment was made in this case.
Yeah, so fortunately, just by happenstance in this case, we did have our archaeologists there on site. And so they were able to determine that nothing in that site was historically or naturally significant. So just by assessing how many times something has probably been moved by looking at the ground, looking at the rocks, just looking at the site in general, they are a professional, and that is their work, is to determine those things.
And I know that this is sort of getting into subjective territory, but I'm curious what distinguishes something from vandalism versus something that is historically or culturally significant.
A great example would be when somebody writes their name now onto a sandstone surface, that is vandalism. That is not culturally significant in the way that, say, a fur trapper coming through in the 1800s writing their name as they came through.
This is Amy Schlosser. She's the BLM's archaeologist who made the decision at Otho Bridge.
There are many other ways to record now where you have been. You can write on the internet. You can make a post about it. Hey, I was in Moab. Writing something down, creating artwork on the landscape is vandalism. When we look at historic inscriptions on the wall, we have to consider whether they are significant or not culturally, and that requires a lot of historic research into names, genealogy, looking at people that came here in the past. Just because something is historic doesn't mean it's necessarily significant or needs protection.
I guess I am not trying to encourage people to deface public land at all. What I'm curious about is like how long it would take for people of the Moab community who lived here once and carved a chessboard into a slab of sandstone to become culturally significant. I guess, like, if the archaeologist who found Otho Bridge hadn't gone there for another 30 years or so, would it have needed to be assessed further for cultural significance?
I cannot see an instance where this would become significant.
Regardless of how much time elapsed?
Regardless of how old it becomes.
You were talking earlier about the criteria that you use to judge a site like this. And, you know, you said it's like pages and pages long. It's very intricate and requires a lot of nuance. But to the best of your ability, could you summarize what some of those criteria are?
Sure. So there are four criteria to evaluate whether a site is significant and could be listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Criteria A would be, can I tie it to a national, local, or regional event in our history, like broad patterns of history? Criteria B, can I tie it to an important person in local, regional, or national significance? Criteria C, design and construction methods, or D, research potential?
You know, in most instances, I'm like, yes, all of this is vandalism when I see that kind of thing out and about. But I think that a lot of people in town would consider this a culturally and historically significant site. And I'm just curious if that is ever taken into consideration by the BLM or by like the community of people who go there the most or anything like that.
What I would say is that while there may be individuals who enjoyed this particular graffiti and vandalism, the character of the place would be to leave it natural and provide the opportunity for people who are visiting to have the experience of wilderness.
Okay, so based on what we're talking about, where this site, for example, would have never been considered significant, even if it was like 100 years old, I'm curious if there will be new culturally significant archaeological sites that are created like today that eventually will be protected in some way. Like, are new places that are somewhat modern, are they being discovered and being preserved?
That's a question for the future. I don't think that there is a clear answer to that. And there is so much history in Moab. We're living here, we're recreating here. And if everybody wanted to be a part of the history by altering the landscape or writing on the walls, then what sort of history are we really leaving behind?
As the 50-year rule continues to move on, as we move on into the future, sites that were not considered prior, you know, like in the 1990s, these sites are now being considered for eligibility for the National Register of Historic Places. And these types of sites include like uranium sites and Cold War sites. So things are analyzed
as they reach that 50-year mark. But you can't really tell. Time will tell what becomes important in the future.
How did you feel when you saw that things had been dismantled the last time you went out there?
I figured it was something that wouldn't last forever, and I was ready for that to happen. I just wasn't expecting it right then, I guess. Definitely left a little empty feeling in my stomach. I had no desire to put it back together or anything. It's still a beautiful place to go visit and beautiful place to hang out, but it's definitely different feel.
Thanks to KZMU's Emily Arnson. You're listening to the Regional Roundup from Rocky Mountain Community Radio. The Sundance Film Festival is underway in Park City, Utah. After more than four decades in the state, the festival will relocate to Boulder, Colorado, beginning next year. At one of the opening events, Amy Redford acknowledged the transition. Her father, Robert Redford, established the festival in 1978.
This festival has found a new iteration, which will be exciting, and it will be imperfect. And it might just feel like our beginnings over 40 years ago.
Representatives from Boulder have been visiting this year's festival in preparation for next year's Colorado debut. Speaking last April, when Boulder was announced as the festival's future home, Democratic State Representative Brianna Titone pointed to the tax incentives as a key part of the pitch.
The film office came to us and said we'd like to offer a tax credit for the festival and the small festivals as well. And I said, sign me up.
Titone, who is Colorado's first openly transgender lawmaker, says while economic incentives likely played a major role in the decision to move the festival to Boulder, Colorado's progressive policies were also a factor.
I've heard anecdotally about some people who have been to some of the festivals in Utah and kind of didn't really feel that warm, fuzzy feeling because there's just that overarching disdain for the LGBT community in particular. We don't have that here. We're very welcome. We're very open. This is the West where we have libertarian values, a lot of folks, I mean the governor in particular, and we just want people to be themselves and be who they are, and that's a place where you want to have a festival like this to tell these amazing stories of diversity and feel comfortable doing it and be out in the community celebrating who people are with the wins and the awards that are given out. And I think that Boulder is the right place.
At this year's festival in Park City, beyond the film screenings and premieres, there were forums and conversations on a variety of issues. One of those was the Justice Summit, held Saturday, January 24th, which centered on sentencing reform, clemency, and reentry for people leaving the criminal justice system. Among the participants was Noella Sudbury, the CEO and founder of Rasa Legal, an organization that helps people understand, and in some cases, expunge their criminal records. Sudbury says a key focus of the summit was storytelling, led by people with lived experience of the justice system. KRCL's Laura Jones spoke with Sudbury about why these stories matter and how they can help drive real change.
The people who are coming out have the most incredible stories, and any one of them should be a movie. And so by bringing these storytellers here, people who have lived experience, who have been through hard things, overcome those things and are now themselves leading nonprofits, leading startups, being advocates for legislation, both on the state level and on the national level. As we bring them out here to Park City, to Sundance, to tell their stories, we're hoping that we can connect their stories to filmmakers, artists, others who have platforms who can help tell those stories and make sure that everyone in America can understand just what incredible people there are that have been through the justice system and are now doing incredible things, really changing the face of formerly incarcerated people.
You know, our criminal justice system and what we say out loud is we believe in second chances and do the crime, do the time, but the consequences after you've done your time are still incredibly harsh. And when we talk about programs like one of your panels is filmmaking and the arts in prison, folks freak out and say, I don't have the arts out of prison. Sorry, I'm being dramatic. It's Sundance. But the quality of our justice is mercy, right? So acknowledging the whole person is a huge part of reentry, a huge part of rehabilitation, not only of the person who's been through the justice system, but the community at large.
Absolutely. And the reality is that over 90% of incarcerated people are going to come home someday. And so what programming is available, what resources are available to help them while they're inside are very much going to shape what type of person they're going to be on the outside when they're released. And one approach is just to lock them up and not give them access to anything. But then imagine as that person's reentering a community, they're not going to be set up for success. They're not going to be able to contribute versus helping them to heal, helping them to use things like art to deal with and process trauma and things like digital literacy or workforce programs that can prepare them to enter their communities and work are extremely important.
Why is it so important that you do this work?
Technology is just such a critical part, in my view, of criminal justice reform. It's a really exciting time, right? AI is just changing the world and in so many ways. And so many people who are formerly incarcerated don't have access to devices, to computers while they're in prison. And so we have this huge digital literacy gap as people are reentering communities. And with all of this rise in technology, there needs to be more technology for formerly incarcerated people. And so at ROSA, I'm really, really passionate about using technology to help people access the justice system more easily, get access to their criminal records, and get through the legal process to get those records cleared and moving on with their lives. And for me, technology also has the power to scale our impact, right? Utah Legal Services does incredible work. They're able to serve 400 people a year. With our software, ROSA has now been able to help more than 25,000 people. And that's the power of tech. That's the power of building an app and putting the justice system and access to a lawyer on someone's phone. That's possible to do, but we need to build it. And there needs to be more tech, more startups, more entrepreneurs focused on building tools for formerly incarcerated people that work, that are scalable, and can help kind of bridge the gap between reentering without a lot of skills, without a lot of digital literacy often, to help them have a marketplace of opportunity and connect what they need.
Noella Sudbury, CEO and founder of ROSA Legal in Utah, was speaking with KRCL's Laura Jones about the Justice Summit that took place as part of the Sundance Film Festival. This is the last year that the festival is in Utah. Starting next year, it will be taking place in its new home of Boulder, Colorado. You've been listening to The Regional Roundup, a production of Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a network of public and community radio stations in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, including this one. Thanks to Aspen Public Radio's Hallie Zander, KHOL's Jenna McMurtry, KDNK's Lily Jones, KZMU's Emily Arnson, and KRCL's Laura Jones for today's show. Our theme music is Take Me Somewhere by Joel Adam Russell. I'm Caroline Yanez in for Maeve Conrad. Thanks for listening.
This has been Locomotion on KVNF. I'm Brody Wilson. Thanks so much for listening. Locomotion airs every Tuesday at 5 p.m. and Saturday at 10 a.m. If you ever miss a Locomotion on air that you want to hear, you can always find past episodes by looking under the news tab at kvnf.org and looking for Locomotion. Thanks so much for listening.